data to work from. So what she was doing was actually much more complicated. So she created these maps. And then what happened is that all of these other people, men, came along and started writing all of these theories, developing all of these theories, writing papers. And what they were doing was looking at her maps. But they weren't citing her maps, which is really problematic, right? Because without those maps to
remedied?
Well, in some ways, I think within the scientific community and especially within geology, people know her name. I mean, the maps are hanging on the walls of geology departments all over the country. But at the same time, when I go do talks and things and I talk about the importance of marine and I tell people what I just told you, which is that if you don't have anything to look at, how are you going to write the papers? Scientists will come up to me and they'll say, well, I never thought of it that way. And I think that's really fascinating that something so simple can be overlooked in that way.
Hallie Felt, thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Hallie Felt is the author of Soundings, the story of the remarkable woman who mapped the ocean floor. And thanks to our production team. You can't see them, but you can hear their hard work. Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
And thanks to support from Rena Schulsky David and Sammy David and the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to Invisible Worlds. You can find more Big Picture Science on iTunes and through the link on our website. And while you're online, you might also find and download our Big Picture Science app. You can find it on iTunes, Android, and Windows 8.
If you're a podcast listener, but you prefer over-the-air radio because it's just part of your idiosyncratic machismo, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, well, consider letting them know you like this show.
Hi, this is Jawbone. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Our guest today is Penny Kelly. Penny is a writer, teacher, author, publisher, consultant, and naturopathic physician. She has been researching consciousness and perception for over 35 years. For more than 25 years, she has been the owner and director of Lily Hill Farm and Learning Center in Lawton, Michigan, where she offers spiritual consulting and teaches courses in developing intuition and the gift of consciousness, getting well, again, naturally, and organic gardening. For some years, she has been involved in scientific research and investigations into consciousness at Pinelandia Laboratory near Ann Arbor, Michigan, with biophysicist the late William C. Levengood. She and Levengood collaborated in scientific investigations of crop formations, cattle mutilations, UFO materials, contactees and people with unusual abilities of consciousness. So here to share some of the results of these investigations is Penny Kelly. Hello, Penny.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. It's really, and I'm so overjoyed that it's spring or almost spring. So
it's
I could
spring.
Say I'm great.
Really? Really? Well, this will be airing the first Tuesday of April. So who knows what it'll be like? Maybe snow.
Oh, don't say that.
But it's really nice today anyway.
It is.
Yeah, so tell me, Penny, tell our listeners, how did you first get involved with the UFO and related phenomena?
I think it started slowly, gradually. I had a couple of sightings where I just there was a vehicle, a spaceship, a UFO, right in front of me, probably 200 feet, 300 feet away.
Really?
And it was hovering. I was on Jefferson Avenue in the Grosse Pointe area, and I was on the lake shore and going to have a little picnic with some fellow students, and there it was. And we all just stopped, and somebody said, "What's that?"
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it was obvious that it was something very, very different because it had this kind of rounded cap on it, and then there were rows of lights that were circling around it. And then all of a sudden, after, we were kind of transfixed for a minute, it took off and it went down and it hovered over Grosse Pointe Yacht Club for about 15 seconds, maybe 30 seconds, and then all of a sudden it just shot up and disappeared into space.
Mm.
That was my first real sighting. So there have been a few others since then.
Really? How many people in that original sighting, how many people were with you in that
party?
There
were probably six or seven of us. We had just gotten out of class, and we were going to go down and sit by the lake and, just relax a little bit.
Mm.
Everybody saw it. Everybody.
So if it hovered over the golf club, were there any golfers out there at the time?
No, it was out at the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. It is over the water.
Oh, you say Yacht Club?
Yacht Club,
I thought it's a golf club.
And I just, the way that it moved, we were probably, I'm going to say, maybe a quarter mile from the yacht club.
Mm-hmm.
And it shot, from where we were up and over. And then it was probably, because it was maybe only, 50 to 100 feet above the water.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not even that much.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when it moved so silently and so swiftly. It was just like, boom, boom. And it was there. And then, when it went up into outer space or wherever it went, way, way up, disappeared.
Yeah. Well, if you couldn't see it any longer, was it cloudy that day? Or?
No, it was absolutely beautiful. It was clear. It was sunny. It was evening, early evening, maybe 6:30 or thereabouts, 7 o'clock.
Mm.
And it was summertime. So.
Mm-hmm. Daytime? Still light, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yep. So I, that was the first one, and then I had a couple of other experiences. And it took me a long time before I could talk about, a few of the others, but, I think the one that was a turning point, I was living in, Bloomfield Township up by the airport in the Pontiac region.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone to listen to a folk singer one night at a little bar. And they had live music, and I was going to meet somebody there, and so I drove myself and stayed until it was over. And I was driving back home, and I think I was weaving. I'd have to go back and look at a map. Somewhere between Cass Lake and Elizabeth Lake, and I stopped at a red light, and And that's, I noticed a light behind me, a very unusual light. It seemed to be, instead of pulling up behind me, it seemed to be descending behind me. And all I could remember was all of a sudden I couldn't move. And and that was Friday night. And I woke up and it was, I thought, or maybe it was Saturday night. I'd have to go back and look at my notes. But I woke up on Monday morning and had zero recall of the weekend. And I kind of put it aside, you know, how you do. Mm-hmm. Like, what? It's Monday? I thought this would be Sunday.
One of those things.
It must
have
been Saturday night that I was going to listen. So those were the two big ones.
Okay, now you know what the skeptic out there is going to say. Mm-hmm. She came from a bar.
Yeah, yeah, well.
She must have had a really wonderful time at the bar.
Yeah, well, I know all of that. But, you know, there comes the point, and you could, if you're really digging for, you know, for, what would you call it, arguments that would counter everything that somebody's going to say about UFOs and ETs, you can do that. But the fact of the matter is, it comes down to you end up either having to trust your own consciousness or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the bottom line. And I think we're slowly getting to that point where to have somebody say, no, you didn't see that, is the height of insanity. I mean, who is it that thinks he's great enough to be doing my perception for me?
Wasn't even there, but he's going to tell you what you saw and what you didn't see.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy.
And I say this kind of often on the show. I got a friend who uses the analogy that people do not get drunk and see UFOs. They see UFOs, then they go get drunk. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I did have, I'm sure I had something to drink while I was there, but I don't drink a lot.
Yeah.
And I never drink and drive. And so, you know, that's just not my way.
Right. Well, it would seem you had that first sighting. Back to that first sighting, did, say there were six or seven people there. Did you discuss it among yourself?
We did. You know, we were just getting to the lakeshore. We were just putting our blankets down, and you know, there was absolute silence after we saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, finally somebody said something like this. We had taken a couple bottles of wine down to the lakeshore with us, and somebody said, it's a good thing we didn't open that wine yet, or I would have thought it was the effect of the wine. And we talked about it a little bit and how amazing it was. But we were all onto other things, you know, relationships and classes and exams were coming up and all of that. So.
But this thing being that close to, you know, it wasn't just one of those light in the sky deals, you know?
Oh, no, it was not. I could see a lot of detail on that ship.
Was the periphery rotating?
Yes, it was.
Was it wobbling?
No, I don't remember it wobbling. I remember that there were four rows of lights in this periphery that was circulating.
Okay.
And the lights were white, except for there was a slanted or diagonal break in those lights, in those white lights, and the diagonal was blue lights. And so that's how you could see that it was rotating, because this diagonal line of blue lights would disappear over to the right and go behind and then come back. It was rotating in a counterclockwise manner. And in the ship itself, the metal of it looked either like aluminum or silver. It was silvery in color. And it was really very beautiful. Very beautiful.
Did it make any sound?
Not a sound.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And I had this very, very clear awareness as I was watching this thing that it was there very deliberately. And that it wanted, I don't know about the rest of the people, but it wanted me to see that ship at that proximity and to have to acknowledge in front of other people that it was there.
So how long period of time was it between that first sighting and the missing time incident?
Oh, wow. Well, there were a couple of other sightings, but let's see if I can... I'm going to guess and say it was probably... oh, gosh. I'm going to say maybe 4 or 5 years.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were the other sightings in between as dramatic as the first?
No.
No?
No. The second one was just seeing a ship going by.
Mm.
I thought a couple years ago here on the farm that some kind of ship came up my driveway.
Oh.
And it turned out it was two very brilliant blue lights, and they made a crop circle in my yard and you know, traveled all the way back to the back of the farm and disappeared.
Right.
And so that, I don't think that was a ship at all. That was just part of the phenomena of energy and
right.
some of the things that energy does.
Right. Yeah, I just got back from another MUFON meeting, I saw a video of this crop formation, and the people are quite a little ways away, but close enough on the road. These lights were just swooping down from the sky.
Yep.
And hovering in the field.
Yep.
And then getting really bright and fading away. And then they'd come again.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for the longest time. You know? And I've seen that before, these lights forming crop circles.
Yeah.
And this one, I don't know if you saw the one on sightings years ago.
No.
Well, this was, I guess, one of the most famous ones where these little... lights. It was in Britain. It was in the UK, and these little lights were dancing around in the field and actually forming this crop formation.
Yeah.
And the photographer saying, "Look at this! This is amazing!" And they had a guy, a video analyst, analyze this, and he couldn't find anything indicating the video was a hoax. But he says, "I still think it's a hoax."
Well,
why do you think it's a hoax? Well, because if it were me, I'd be screaming to the top of my lungs.
Oh.
But this guy is just saying, "Oh, look at this. Isn't this amazing?" That's just too British.
Yeah.
So the reason, although the analyst couldn't find anything to indicate a hoax, the reason he thought it was a hoax because the photographer was too British.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So, you know.
You know, that doesn't really he has a right to his opinion, but it doesn't constitute anything scientific or even reasonable. What he's saying is, this is my personal opinion.
That's it.
Yeah.
Preconceived idea, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that when you begin to step into the world of energy, mm-hmm. raw energies, you begin to see why certain things happen and how they happen, and it explains a lot, from ghosts and crop circles to UFOs and ETs and a lot of things. And at first, it might be considered scary, but then when you realize this is just how the world works,
right.
It's not scary at all. It's common sense.
Now, when you say ghosts and UFOs in the same sentence, it brings me to this question that I ask many of my guests. And that is, do you feel the UFO phenomenon is extraterrestrial and or other dimensional in origin?
Well, it's some of both. It is definitely other dimensional, absolutely other dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
It is some of those other dimensions are extraterrestrial, and some of those beings have evolved to a point where they no longer need a terrestrial base as their place of, you know, to carry out their existence.
Right.
And, you know, and they have the wherewithal to remain, to utilize energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we might be moving in that same direction, slowly, very slowly. And it might be another 1,000 years or so before we actually get there.
Mm-hmm.
But we are very much moving toward becoming extraterrestrials. And I think, given my own research into other dimensional existence, I think we're already there. We have just not stepped into that level of being. We're still hypnotized by the physical,
mm-hmm.
which is a delightful way to live. There's some things that need to be fixed here for sure.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yeah. But it's still, it's a beautiful, there's a beauty here that you don't find in a lot of other places.
Right. Yes, that's true. That's true. But, you mentioned ghosts, and okay, I accept the ghosts. In my first book, I tried to, the whole second part of it is trying to, giving you some personal experiences that I've had with ghosts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and trying to establish that I am spiritual in nature, and the UFO phenomenon is real as well. Now, is there a connection? Well, I didn't think there was a connection between Bigfoot and UFOs for the longest time. But the more you hear these stories and look at the evidence, they see Bigfoot at pretty much, quite often, at the same time that they see a UFO. And then Bigfoot scampers off into the woods, and then they see this ship take off. Is there a connection?
Wow, I haven't heard that, but I will say this. In some of my journeys and work with other dimensions, I have run into some pretty unusual beings who have evolved beyond all anything that we could imagine here.
Mm-hmm.
And they are legitimately they're kind of human. They're humanoid, but they're not human. And they are incredibly wise, intelligent, patient, creative, etc.
Yeah.
I think I got to go back to the ghost thing.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're coming to, I think, as a population, and science has been very slow in getting this kind of information out there. But when something happens in any locality, any dimension at all, that event, that word, that action is imprinted forever in this stuff that we call spirit. It's really light.
Mm-hmm.
And that is forever there, forevermore. And so it is very, very possible to have ghosts because that event, whatever it was, it could be something trivial and it could be something traumatic, was imprinted into the energy of a particular location and the lights of that location. And every so often it cycles around and manifests itself again and again and again and again.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah,
if you're on that same wavelength, you're going to see it.
That's it. I need to take a short break just to remind my listeners here that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. 30 years and we're just getting started. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with the UFO researcher and director of the Lily Hill Farm and Learning Center in Lawton, Michigan. Miss Penny Kelly. So back to you, Penny. We were saying about the ghosts and.
I think we have finally a few people anyway beginning to look at the nature of plasma and the nature of light, and beginning to see that when plasma gathers, the light it gives off light. And it depends on how it's moving, and it depends on how dense it is in terms of the plasma itself. But once you get, let's say, a vortex going, you're going to get lights because the voltage down at the bottom of that vortex can be upwards of 10,000 volts.
Mm.
So you end up able to illuminate, you know, something, a small ball of light forms, and has tremendous, tremendous energies
right.
that we haven't even begun to explore yet.
Right. Now, I had the pleasure of having W.C. Levengood on the TV version of We Are Not Alone several years ago, and he and I became pretty good friends, but I know that you two saw a lot more of each other than over the years, and so tell us what kind of man Levengood was.
He was interesting, that's for sure. He was eccentric. And he was brilliant, and he was, I think in his younger days, I know in his younger days, that he was pretty, he was a pretty sassy boy, okay?
Yeah. Now, what do you mean by that, sassy boy?
He knew he was good, and he didn't mind making sure that somebody else knew that. He was a little bit on the arrogant side, and these are his words about himself, and that he used to be quite arrogant, and that he used to love the competition between scientists. He had a small lab, and he had scientists from around the world who would come to visit, and they would work together. But I discovered that scientists are incredibly competitive, and they often ended up in an argument over who was smarter, who was right.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a kick out of that. And he had eventually grown and matured to the point that he was not interested in the argument anymore. He said, I got interested in the truth.
Right.
And then he became, as he got older, more and more humble, more and more impatient about wasting time on things that had no meaning. And he really, really focused. And I spent the last 15 years of his life working with him, studying with him. He was my private mentor in biophysics and astrophysics for about 10 of those years.
Mm.
And we had a good time in the lab. And it was a difficult time for him because he was trying to take care of his wife,
yeah.
who had Alzheimer's.
Right.
And, it was a very, very productive time. He wanted me to write about his work, what he felt his true work was. And he said, nobody will publish this. I can't even get my regular stuff published because he was being blackballed by the scientific establishment because he was interested and willing to publish reports about crop circles and UFO
yeah.
materials and cattle excisions.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the first paper he came out with where he, you know, he never mentioned UFO. He talked about energy, whatever energy that might be, usually in the case of crop formations. Microwave energy.
Right.
And the microwave energy did this, but never the UFO. Well, the first paper came out, he sent to me, and it had, the UFO was hovering over the field, and I called him. I said, Lefty, you said UFO. He says, yeah, it's time. He says, I don't care anymore. They want to ridicule me, let them. I'm too old.
That's right. That's right. He said, I'm not willing to play the games. There were a few things that he was bothered about. One of them was that one of his interests was meteorology.
Mm.
And he had a number of friends who were very well-known scientists in meteorology. And they had been talking about what was happening in the weather and the fact that the weather was being manipulated very deliberately to create trouble for people. And one day they all shut up, absolutely wouldn't discuss it anymore, were even warned not to send emails, that their emails were being monitored, and to one another. And he said, you know, they're just playing games with everybody.
Who's the they here?
He wasn't sure who the they was. Mm-hmm. All he knew was that he had gotten word that there was to be no more discussion of the truth about climate change and what was happening, and that there were a number of anomalies that were that he had they had traded different papers and different photographs and different weather maps and things between and among themselves, and I have a couple of those here, and they were very, it was clear, you do not get a perfect donut-shaped form in natural weather, and there were a number of those over Indiana, you know, other places, sometimes Grand Rapids, and he saw those because there was a point in time when the Weather Channel, he would get up at 2 a.m.,
yeah,
and he would maybe watch a little bit of the weather to see what was going to happen. And he said quite a few nights they would be showing the screen of the radar map, and across the screen comes this perfect donut. And, you know, he and his friends were talking about, what the heck? You know, that is not a natural formation. Who's messing with the weather?
Perfect donut shape of what? Radar return?
Some sort of energetic radar being, you know, and it would be in place for maybe a day or two, and then it would move somewhere else. And so, you know, they were forbidden to talk about that anymore.
Well, they say that 95 to 97% of scientists agree that climate change is, you know, we all see that the climate is changing. I mean, the weather is changing, and it's getting goofy. The question, the debate is man's activity, mankind's activity, partly to fault? And, of course, corporate America says, no, corporate world says, no, you know, it costs us too much to fix that. So, no, we can keep on doing what we're doing.
Yeah, well, they, you know, that is the issue. Is it a man-made problem? And yes, it is, but it's not the man-made problem that people think it is. The man-made problem is that there is weather technology that they use to manipulate the jet stream, and that is a man-caused problem.
Okay.
But fossil fuels and all of that, I think that's irrelevant. And I know people would crucify me for saying that. However, you know, the natural cycles of the planet Earth are very much more diverse than what we are prepared for. So there's some of that going on, but it's really more of a cooling than it is a heating.
Right.
So.
Well, so are we talking about HAARP?
I think we're beyond HAARP. I think there's technology that's way beyond HAARP. But I think it started with HAARP.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have the capacity to greatly heat up a certain area using HAARP, but there are other things that they're doing now
so,
that are very much more powerful than HAARP ever thought of being.
Really? So if they're when I say they, the mysterious they,
yeah,
if they are manipulating the weather, why don't they correct things, correct the droughts in California, correct the floods elsewhere, stop the hurricanes?
Well, that would make common sense for you and I.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking common sense now. Oh,
yeah.
And we're talking government and common sense at the same time. That's like military
intelligence.
Well, the
weather thing is being used as a war. I mean, when I first read the first reports on the weather technology, and these were the early technologies, one of the major conclusions written in that paper was that this was an excellent way to make war on an enemy and not be blamed for it and not have to send men or spend money, or send machinery, you could just say, oh, Mother Nature did it. So here we are, you know, 20 years later, and it's become pretty awful in a few places.
Yeah.
And, you know, and outrageous things are happening. In Bolivia last year, half the country was underwater. In Australia a couple years ago, it was the same thing. They've got a permanent new inland sea in Australia that was the result of so much rain.
Mm.
We got the droughts in California. Wheat crops burned up in Russia a few years ago. They had zero rain. That's just not very natural.
Yeah. And there's glacier melting.
Yeah.
That is affecting the sea levels. And,
yeah.
And it, people blindly say, oh, you know, it's just natural earth changes. Well, if it is, then, you know, head for higher ground because Mother Nature's on a rampage.
I know.
You know?
I know. And they never point out that the sea ice melting in the Arctic happens to be right above a whole chain of volcanoes that are acting up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and they don't ever say, oh, and the glaciers in, I think it's Mont Blanc in Switzerland or in that area are growing a foot a day. Mm. So, you know, when you put it all together, you have to take into account the natural things. And the, you know, the fact that the Earth is a living system.
Right.
And then the, you know, the people who get into power and want to make things happen their way. And do so without regard to human or animal life.
Hmm. So there is evidence to show that scientists have been warned away from discussing the earth changes, the weather changes, and the fact that they are being manipulated by man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've known that Lefty was quite irritated about that and felt that it was, quote, none of their business. you know, and that was just his way of discussing it.
What was
and
that?
I said to him, why don't you protest? And he said, girl, you know, you have to learn where you want to put your time and energy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. What are you going to do about it, you know?
That's where it's at.
They'll deny it and walk away. And the average person is going to say, well, our scientists tell us that's not true, so the guy must be wacko. So.
Well, you know what, David? I think we're coming to a point in time where some of the research that Lefty and I did into consciousness is really going to become a factor that makes it clear that you cannot tell or let somebody else tell you what to believe and how to believe and when to believe and when to drop that, et cetera.
Mm.
Consciousness is yours. It's yours to do what you choose with.
Right, right. So before, you know, I didn't know Lovingood before he accepted the UFO phenomena. So maybe you know, before he became involved in the UFO phenomena, what were his views on the subject?
You know, before he became involved in it, he considered it to be the you know, the area or the purview of crazy people.
No.
He wanted no part of it. He didn't believe in it. He thought it was, you know, insane, etc. But a number of things happened that he began to say, wow, somebody ought to be investigating this energy, this phenomena, these kinds of materials. And it took a few years. It probably was, I'm going to say, 3 to 4 years before he realized it was going to be him.
Mm.
And he said it just came to a point that he felt that there was too much to gain, and he really didn't care about his reputation, and he was partly, mostly even retired, and so he said, yeah, I'll investigate that, and I will write a report with my laboratory letterhead on it, and you can say I said so.
Very good. Very good. Need to take one more quick break, I should say, to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with the researcher Penny Kelly. So, Penny, how did you and Lovingood get involved with the crop formations, and what was discovered about them?
Ooh, that's a big question. He was actually involved with the crop formations long before I came on the scene.
Oh.
He started in 1988, 89, et cetera, right in that time frame. And he was basically saw a program on TV. Goanna said, come and look at this, Lefty. You know, they got these plants doing strange things. And he was so fascinated. He loved plants.
Mm-hmm.
He was a biophysicist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I said to him, what did you think about the program? And he was like, well, you know, I didn't think anything of it. They didn't say anything worth listening to.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, what? But it was, you know, for me, it was an indication that the scientist views the world much differently. They're looking for evidence,
right.
And they're looking for statements that they can get their teeth into.
Right.
So he was already doing that for 10 years, and then by that time he had moved from crop circle investigation and just the materials. He was only willing to see what was going on with the plants and what was happening, you know, with the soil and et cetera.
Mm.
So then that became Linda Moulton Howe. Started, mm. You know, Lefty, would you investigate these animal excisions? And he said, nope, absolutely not. But I will look at the plants and the soil around where those animals are found and discovered a whole bunch of strange anomalies in the energy of those plants.
Such as?
Well.
Such as?
And then it moved from that to UFO, evidence of places where UFOs had been reported. And sure enough, there was an energetic change in all of the vegetation around places where a UFO had been spotted. And one, and I just have to say this, one of the things that became obvious after a while was that every single living thing, plant, animal, or human, is an energetic system. And if it comes into contact with another energetic system, it will be imprinted and shifted forever.
Hmm.
Everything leaves an energetic fingerprint on everything it touches. And so by that time, he had moved from UFOs, and he was realizing that there were a number of people out there who were very unusual and had unusual energies. And so he started working with, I think it was John Mack, and investigating items, you know, from people who had been contactees or abductees. And then he just, after that, he started looking for people who had unusual energies.
Mm.
And that was how he and I met. And that, you know, I went over to the lab and he said, let me test you. And so he did. And he never really said anything that first visit. It wasn't until years later when I said to him, well, what did you think when I came in? And he said, there's only been two people in this lab in 30 years that have had the same kind of signal that you have. And he said, it's you and Ed. And he said, I said, well, what was unique about the signal? And he said, your ability to not waste energy.
Hmm.
And I was like, oh, okay. And so there's a management capacity that people who learn to husband and manage their energy, there's a management skill that you learn, and that showed up in the equipment. So.
Right. So did you and Lovingood find that there was the same telltale evidence of energy, not only in soil samples where allegedly UFOs landed, mm-hmm. and crop formations and cattle mutilations, Was there a common denominator there?
Yeah, the common denominator was what he called a change in the charge density pulses, or the amount of energy in these pulses that everything had that had been in contact with UFOs or with other dimensional beings, or were actually kind of hybrid items that could go into either dimension. They all had, on the average, about 60% more energy at their disposal.
And your abilities and your energies, this remarkable energy that Lemongood discovered in you, do you connect that with this missing time incident or your UFO sighting incidents?
You know, David, I have a, I'm not sure, but I'll say a couple things. I had this missing time experience, and that was, oh gosh, I'm going to say 1977, 78, somewhere in there. I think it was 77. And then in 1979, I had a full-blown Kundalini experience, series of experiences.
Describe that.
That went on for over 3 years. And there's such a huge change in your energy. And I have asked myself many times if there was a connection between the two, and I haven't really got one single bit of proof. But my gut says something happened or something was shifted or changed in me in that missing time experience, in which I was either set up or something, or shifted, altered in some way, and the Kundalini experience occurred as a result of that.
Okay, now, for the sake of our listeners who say, Kundalini, what's that?
Yeah.
briefly explain that.
Okay, so Kundalini is a term. It's a term that comes from the East, and it means or is defined as the full spontaneous awakening of consciousness. And when that occurs, it is an energetic event in the body and in the mind and in the emotions and in your thinking, and your whole sense of spirituality. And one of the things that happens is this intense heat that is so intense that it can and does occasionally burn somebody up. People melt and burn up from the inside.
That's spontaneous human combustion you're talking about, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. And in science, it's called idiopathic thermogenesis. And that idiopathic means we don't know what causes it, and thermogenesis means spontaneous combustion. And so, you know, that's one of the things. And then you have these amazing states of consciousness where you have no limits on your consciousness, and I mean no limits. And that is very confusing and very frightening. Your consciousness is bouncing all over the place, or at least mine was. And learning to manage that is a very took a long time. It took almost 3 years. And so you, in that time, you read people's minds. You're in and out of the body. You have spontaneous orgasms, which are a big nuisance, and they're embarrassing. You have this ability to see what is going to happen as well as what already did happen. It's pre- and post-cognition. It's an incredible level of clairvoyance and clairaudience. You hear and see other beings. And I think the most basic and probably most useful change is that you can now see the light that everything is made from. And that is very handy. So
it sounds very similar to what near-death experiencers report. Some of them say, I found that I knew everything. Everything there was to know.
Yep,
I mean, it's just
exactly
complete
right.
consciousness. And now, Joyce Hagelthorne, was one of our dear friends.
Oh, I loved her.
Yes, indeed. She got me introduced to the TV show and through her TV show.
Yeah.
And so that long story there, but she she said that she had a near-death experience, and that was what happened to her. Although once she was back in the body, she forgot most or all of it, but she was aware of the fact that she just knew everything.
Yeah, it's such a profound experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to communicate that very well, because until you experience it, you cannot even begin to grasp how powerful and how unlimited that kind of consciousness is. And the reason it happens at a near-death experience is so often is because once you're not bound by all of the rules of perception that you happen to pick up over the course of your life, or by all of the limitations of the physical vehicle, then, you know, those rules go out the window, those limitations disappear, and you have unlimited consciousness.
Well, kind of gives us something to look forward to.
It really does.
Don't want to get there too fast, but yeah, that's what I say. But now, Lemgood had at least two UFO-related experiences, sighting and, well, you tell us about them. You're aware of that, don't you? Aren't you?
You know, I'm not sure which ones you're referring to.
Well, he got up in the middle of the night and saw a UFO from his back porch.
Yeah, out over this little lake that was behind the house.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
And then he heard some crash.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
You know, I don't know if I remember all the details of that, but let's just limit it to, he was, I think he was in the lab. He heard this crash. He had this little back porch off of the lab, and it was on the second floor. And he went outside, and the wrought iron railing on a part of that fence had been destroyed. And there was no explanation. And there was never any, I mean, he wasn't sure whether to call that a UFO experience. You know, we joked about calling it a UPE, which was an unidentified perceptual experience. But we never did come up with a logical, physical reason for why that railing on the porch would suddenly self-destruct.
I've got pictures in my computer somewhere of that railing.
Oh, okay.
And it was not just destroyed. I mean, it was wrought iron.
Yeah.
And it was bent as if it were in misconfigured and bent.
Yeah.
As if it were heated.
Yeah, like a crop circle.
Yeah, as if it were heated and then bent under pressure. But I guess he had that analyzed, and there was no signs of heat.
That heat did it.
You know, and it's like this one thing with a car. I forget the name of the woman or where she was, but she's driving along in her car, and she sees a UFO, and it comes right up to her car, and she felt the bump of it.
Wow.
But it didn't really hit her car. She got out of the car, and the whole side of the car, a brand-new car, was wavy. The metal was wavy, but there was no dent, no scratch, no tearing of the metal.
Right.
It was just as if the whole thing were melted down and nicely reformed into these waveforms. And what?
And that is exactly what that energy does.
Yeah.
And what you discover is that the external form, or what we came to again and again, the external form of anything is maintained by the pattern of the energy underlying that form. And when the energy changed, then the physical form changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is being used, I think, nowadays in the new kind of medicine that is energy medicine. They have, there's a technology out there, and that technology just simply resets your energy body, and when it does, it erases all of the disease and dysfunction that you had 5 minutes before.
Wait a minute. Where do I find this?
It's over in Europe. It's not something available here yet, but it's being done in a few places, and it's absolutely stunning.
Doctors would hate that financially more than they do Obamacare, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know what? I think Obamacare is probably a day late and a dollar short.
Probably.
So we're moving into a form of medicine now that is absolutely astounding. And I think we're going to look back on the medical field, even though, you know, several of my children are involved in the medical field and their livelihood depends on it. I think we're going to look back on these kinds of ways that we deal with illness and go, oh, my God, they might as well have been doing bloodletting and mercury.
Yeah. Like on Star Trek, Bones, when they came back to 1988 or whatever it was, 1985, they looked at some of the technologies they use and some of the methods they use for, they said, how barbaric.
I know. And it was. And it is.
Yeah. What you going to do?
And I think nutrition is finally, you know, beginning to, people are beginning to pay attention to nutrition. And the little bit that happens that is not nutrition related is certainly can be dealt with using energy. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But can I still have my burger?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Penny.
Yeah, those kinds of things. You have to eat in accordance with your DNA.
Yes.
And it's that's a very personal thing. And so the
My granddaughter is a vegetarian. And I say, honey, you know, we humans are carnivorous animals. We're meant to eat meat. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think we should be much more flexible. Some days, some years of your life, you need to be carnivorous, and other times you need to be totally vegan.
And just
and
have a salad.
It depends on what you're trying to accomplish in the body.
That's right. That's right.
But to say that you're going to do one forever, I mean, that's like, I can't really say a whole lot because of Lefty's diet, you know?
Yeah.
But I was going to say,
yeah,
that's like Lefty's diet, eating the same one meal a day for 50-some years.
You know, when I had the TV show, the only way I could pay him was to take the guests to lunch.
Oh.
And I took him to lunch at the Chinese restaurant, and he didn't want to eat anything.
No. Nope,
I finally talked him into having an egg roll.
Oh.
So he had an egg roll, but he didn't want anything else. So anyway, very quickly, because we're quickly running out of time, I'm afraid, but your books, you've written books.
Oh, yeah, I have.
And
yeah, I just finished one 2 days ago.
Did you?
So,
what's the name of that one?
It's Consciousness and Energy, Volume 3. And it is, the subtitle is History and Consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, Consciousness and Energy, Volume 1, is multidimensionality and a theory of consciousness. And then Volume 2 is New Worlds of Energy, and that's all my research with Lefty.
Hmm.
And then Volume 3, History and Consciousness, is the one I just finished, and that is the discovery of the history of humanity back 40,000 years, and the reasons, you know, and what has been covered up, and why it has, why that history has been covered up.
Okay.
And
There is a book called Forbidden History that's similar to that, or?
No.
More scientifically.
Yeah, I read Forbidden Archaeology was the name of the one I've read. But it is a, you know, this is more of a personal story that I just kind of kept stumbling forward and, you know, discovering something else. And so basically the book, in this Volume 3, I take on religion, sex, and power and consciousness.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So where can people go to learn more about your work and your farm and your books?
Well, you can go to my website, and that's just my name, www.pennykelly.com. No extra E's in either name. And the website is woefully out of date now because I've been writing buried in my writing closet for about 4 months now. And then I have, my books are all on Amazon. The newest one won't be up there for a couple of weeks yet, but the others are up there. I have 7 books now altogether. So
very good. You say you've been in your writing closet.
Yeah.
So now that you've finished your book, are you ready?
Uh-huh.
You can come out of the closet?
Uh-huh, right.
You knew that was coming, didn't you?
I did.
Dave, you're sick.
Oh, I get so far behind in everything when I'm right at the end, and you have to focus on that book and everything in it so that it comes out as perfect as you can get it.
Right. Penny Kelly, I appreciate you coming on the show. I had an enjoyable conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's really nice to talk with people who have good questions.
Thank you very much. Hope we can do it again.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the home page, and then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, as always, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky. You're listening.
Hi, this is Jill Jack, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Glad you're listening in.
This is WHFR Dearborn. You are listening to the magic of radio.
Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there.
Whether it's a virus, radio wave, or an asteroid.
We have telescopes that are able to survey the skies and find thousands of near-Earth asteroids. If we didn't have the telescopes, the first time they would be visible is about 3 seconds before they hit.
Luckily, we have instruments to make the invisible visible.
Such as the mysterious gravity waves predicted by Einstein.
And while the ocean floor is still terra incognita for most of us, consider how much less we once knew.
It's impossible to see through all that water, obviously. And that's why we have myths